The headlines, Yemeni army says it has fired three ballistic missiles into Saudi Arabia in response to the kingdom's recent deadly airstrikes on Yemen. Thousands of Sudanese take to the streets of the capital, Khartoum, to protest against October's military coup. And videos of a gathering in which Hindu hardliners call for mass killings of Muslims spark outrage in India. We'll bring you a report from New Delhi. Hello and welcome. I'm Marcia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. First story takes us to the situation in Yemen and Saudi Arabia, where the Yemeni army says it has struck sensitive sites in the Saudi port city of Jazan in retaliation for escalating attacks against the impoverished country. Army spokesman Yahya Sadi has promised more painful operations as long as Saudi Arabia continues its crimes and aggression against Yemen. Earlier, we were joined by activist and political commentator Hossein al-Bakhati from Sana'a for more.
It was clear from the statement of the spokesperson of the Yemeni army. He said that three ballistic missiles has hit, as he said, important and sensitive Saudi site, and the claim by the Saudi that two civilians were killed. They were not actually killed by those missiles who were launched yesterday. They were killed by Patriot missiles. We remember that about a year ago when Yemeni army has launched ballistic missiles against Saudi, against Riyadh. We saw in many videos how the Patriot missiles failed to target or to shoot down some of those missiles, and some of them just turned back and they hit the ground. And I believe that news from the Saudi just to cover the failure of the ballistic missile, and it's really silly for Saudi to warn of what they call a large operation to stop those attacks. I mean, Yemen has been under attack for the last 7 years under a blockade. Hundreds of thousands of Yemeni civilians has been killed. Saudi has used all its power. I mean, they haven't got anything new to bring to the battle. They only actually good at killing civilians. Just in the last 24 hours, 25 Yemeni civilians were killed and injured. 10 civilians were killed about 20 hours ago, killed and injured by Saudi airstrike on Al Mahwit in central Yemen, including two children. And on Saada as well, 12 civilians just 1 day ago were killed and injured by Saudi artillery shells. That's why the Saudi latest attack, especially on Sana'a, hitting road, hitting bridges, and hitting Zubairi Street, is one of the busiest street in Yemen. This shows exactly that Saudi actually, they just try to target civilians as they have done from the beginning of the war. More than 150,000 Saudi airstrike has been conducted in Yemen, and nothing actually has changed. Yemeni army still upgrading its missiles, still hitting Saudi site, and those airstrike actually they only target civilians. That's why Yemeni ballistic missile unit has not been affected by any of those strikes conducted by the Saudi coalition.
Next, hashtag trending takes a look at social media reaction to the latest Saudi coalition airstrikes that have targeted residential areas across the Yemeni capital of Sana'a.
Hey everyone, welcome to another hashtag trending with me, Ali Reza. Today, we'll take a look at social media's reactions to the latest coalition airstrikes that targeted residential areas across Yemen's capital, Sana'a. The Saudi-led war on Yemen will soon turn seven years of unabated killings and destruction. Just this past Friday, as you might have heard on the news, the Saudi bombers targeted several locations across the capital city of Sana'a, including a sports complex which hosted the country's national soccer team matches. The Saudis had alleged that the Ansarullah resistance movement was using the Al Thawra sports complex as an arms depot. But that was an unfounded claim, according to Yemeni officials. They have now called on the United Nations for a thorough investigation of the incident. Let's get on with our comments reel with our first tweet coming from Nasreddin Amer, the Deputy Minister of Information of Yemen's National Salvation Government. He said this: "We call on all the media operating in Yemen to visit Al Thawra Sports City in Sana'a to verify that it is free of any weapons, as the coalition of aggression claims, and we are ready to bring them to the stadium." Our next comment comes from Muhammad Abdussalam. He wrote this: "Scenes from the effects and damages of the air raids of the aggression on Al Zubairi Street in Sana'a." Our next tweet comes from Afshin Ratanzi. He said, "Reported photos from Wednesday night's UK-US-EU multi-billion dollar warplane weaponry attacking Al Sabain Maternity and Childhood Hospital in Yemen's capital of Sana'a, in what the UN calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis." True, Yemen remains the world's worst humanitarian crisis, with over 20 million people in dire need of humanitarian assistance. At least one child dies every 10 minutes because of preventable diseases, and in some parts of the country, one out of every four children is now acutely malnourished. Moving on to our next comment by Shaista, it reads, "Kill them before they are born policy, probably. Shame on the Muslim-loathing rogue regimes of UAE/Saudi. Moving on to the next comment by Jay, it reads, "Attempting to eliminate the Arabs and use other Arabic nations to punish the poorest Arabs while the suffering is inhuman, the Arab people are divided again like in 1918 by the Western friends/arsenal of democracy." Over here, Randolph Pitts wrote, "And what are the U.S. headlines? Manchin, Biden, and the ludicrously misnamed Build Back Better bill. The U.S. and the EU's and their associated arms merchants' support of this war should be what the news is focusing on, not squabbles over nothing by unprincipled politicians." Or maybe even this piece of news that got lost during the Christmas hype, that the World Food Program is reducing its food assistance to the starving Yemenis. 400,000 Yemeni children are expected to suffer from life-threatening severe malnutrition in the coming months as a result. Moving on to our final batch of comments, Rhonda wrote this: "Christmas in Yemen, paid for by America's working class due to the corruption and treasonous policies of the United States Congress. Hashtag Yemen." Mahmoud Refat wrote this on Twitter: "Children of Ethiopia and Yemen face same death by famine and bombs, and behind this same perpetrator, money and arms of the UAE and Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia exported terrorism for decades to the whole world, and today the UAE exports genocide." Our final comment for today comes from Chief Sharp Noise. He wrote, "Yemeni babies left without food by Saudi, US, UK, Emirati coalition. Can you imagine their parents? This war crime should be over." Well, that's going to do it for this edition of Hashtag Trending. Let's head back to the studio for the rest of the world news.
A recent report has revealed that Saudi Arabia has become a lucrative market for drug traffickers, emerging as the capital of narcotics consumption in West Asia. According to American magazine Foreign Policy, highly addictive amphetamines known as Captagon pills have recently become popular with the youth in the Arab Kingdom. The growing demand has fueled regional and international trafficking of the substance into Saudi Arabia. Well, the report mentions three drug busts over the last month. To reveal the extent of the Saudi drug problem, Riyadh has failed to stop the illicit trade despite the crackdown. According to the UN Office on Drugs and Crime, more than half of all Captagon seized in West Asia between 2015 and 2019 was in Saudi Arabia. And now to Sudan, where thousands of demonstrators are rallying in the capital, Khartoum, to protest against the military coup and to demand civilian rule. Demonstrators are converging on the presidential palace in the capital. They're also marching on the streets of Madani, a town south of Khartoum. Security forces there are firing tear gas to disperse protesters. Sudan's military leadership has deployed forces across the capital, Khartoum, ahead of the mass protests. Al authorities also cut the internet and telephone lines. The African country has witnessed protests since the military takeover on October the 25th and the arrest of civilian leaders. The rallies are staged despite the reinstatement of Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok, who was ousted in the coup. Dozens of people have been killed and scores of others wounded since then. And now to Iran, where President Ebrahim Raisi says the recent military exercise by the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps shows Tehran's capability to defend its security and national interests. Raisi hailed the IRGC forces for holding the drills. He said any hostile move by the enemy will face a decisive response from the armed forces of the Islamic Republic, which will significantly change strategic equations. The five-day maneuvers in southern Iran were concluded on Friday. They included ballistic and cruise missile attacks on mock enemy targets, featuring a variety of combat and reconnaissance drones and attack helicopters. An advanced homegrown tank, dubbed Kharar, also made a debut. Iran holds military exercises regularly to maintain its combat readiness to deter any act of aggression. Iran and the remaining signatories to its 2015 deal are set to meet in Vienna on Monday for a new round of talks aimed at removing sanctions against Tehran. The parties ended the seventh round of their negotiations last week. Iran has been critical of the European parties, especially France, over what it calls an unconstructive approach. Tehran says the negotiations should result in the full removal of sanctions the U.S. imposed after its 2018 withdrawal from the nuclear deal.
Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian says the Islamic Republic will continue sanctions removal talks in the Austrian capital with seriousness. The Iranian Foreign Minister emphasized that Tehran will never give excessive concessions to the opposite side. Iran's Foreign Minister then criticized non-constructive stances taken by some European signatories to the nuclear deal with Iran during the previous round of talks in Vienna. In the previous negotiations, the positions taken by some European countries, especially by the French, were in general not constructive. We expect the French side to focus on playing a constructive role and help the progress of the negotiations. He also criticized the European side for not putting forward any new initiative in the talks.
I think the Europeans proved that they are unreliable since 2018 and throughout 2021, because when President Donald Trump rejected the JCPOA unilaterally, the European states who signed the JCPOA did not honor their signature and did not commit to what they have agreed upon with Iran. Therefore, it is absolutely clear that Iran cannot rely on the European states, particularly now we're talking about France and Germany, including Great Britain, that is no longer part of Europe, but it is within the European continent, and it's one of the countries that signed the JCPOA.
The top Iranian diplomat recommended that the five remaining signatories to the JCPOA should have no doubt that if they want to give one concession and get 10 concessions in return, the Islamic Republic of Iran will never accept such an approach. The other parties are continuously doing interviews, saying that they are worried about the progress of Iran's nuclear program. We announce it loudly that if you want to alleviate your concerns about Iran's peaceful nuclear program, all JCPOA-related sanctions against Iran must be removed. The Islamic Republic of Iran will continue its strong talks in a logical manner until a good deal is reached. European Union's Deputy Foreign Policy Chief Enrique Mora, who represents the bloc in the Vienna talks between Iran and the P4+1 group of countries, and the EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell, are reported to be making efforts to focus on the negotiations with seriousness. Mora has said that Iran and the five remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear agreement will resume anti-Iran sanctions removal talks in Vienna on Monday to discuss and define the way ahead.
Regarding how things stand before the eighth round of talks begins on December the 27th, reports indicate that all participants were close to reaching a new joint draft that includes two proposed documents by the administration of Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi. Iran's main demand is this: the full removal of the sanctions in a verifiable manner. Police in India have opened an investigation after videos from a religious gathering emerged on social media showing monks advocating ethnic cleansing of Muslims. The police say they will take strict action against those who fan the flame of hatred in the city of Haridwar. Manawar Zaman brings us more from New Delhi.
Panic is on the rise among minorities, particularly Muslims in India. While one can be arrested, threatened, or intimidated for even criticizing the majority, threats against the minorities with vicious hate speeches and ferocious social media campaigns hardly face the courts of law. In recent weeks, several far-right groups with ties to the ruling party have called for ethnic cleansing of minorities, especially the country's Muslims.
Slowly, they are moving towards their target, that is to make India as a fascist country. Unfortunately, the secular parties in India, they are weak, they are not united, they don't pose any challenge to the Hindutva element.
A three-day religious event, which was held in the northern Indian city of Haridwar from 17 to 19 December, faced a tremendous backlash on social and political domains. The event witnessed a dramatic quantity of hate speeches, mobilization threats, and violence against Muslims. Local media reports say some ruling party members also attended the event. Critics say these groups are operating and functioning with a strong political patronage.
Government is trying an agenda which imposed on the Hindutva. They are trying to turn this country into the Hindutva country. And we will never ever allow this government to turn into the Hindutva. We will fight for this democratic right.
They are picking such issues intentionally during elections, and Muslims have always been soft target. Sometimes it's the eating habits of Muslims, sometimes their religious affairs.
While Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi boasts about democracy in India, critics accuse the ruling party of failing to stop violence against the minorities. Since the emergence of ruling BJP in 2014, anti-Muslim sentiments have been on the rise. A police case has been registered to investigate the matter, but there is no arrest yet. Rights activists say there is a less chance of any action by the administration considering the earlier incidents. They say if not addressed in accordance with the rule of the law, it could tear apart social harmony in a diverse country like India, which has a remarkable history of communal violence. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
And that brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Over the last 20 years, the United States has conducted more than 93,300 airstrikes in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Pakistan, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen that killed between 22,679 and 48,308 civilians. According to figures recently released by AirWars, a UK-based airstrike monitoring group, the total number of civilians who have died from direct violence in America's wars since 9/11 tops out at 364,000 to 387,000, according to Brown University's Cost of War project. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Norman Solomon Ryder. This article is published under the heading, "The Pentagon's 20-year killing spree has always treated civilians as expendable." Stay tuned for more. Top U.S. officials want Americans to believe that the Pentagon carefully spared civilian lives while making war overseas. The notion is pleasant, and with high-tech killing far from home, the physical and psychological distances have made it even easier to believe recent claims that American warfare has become humane. Such pretenses should be grimly laughable to anyone who has read high-quality journalism from eyewitnesses reporters like Anand Gopal and Nick Terse. For instance, Gopal's article for the New Yorker in September says the other Afghan women is an in-depth, devastating piece that exposes the slaughter and terror systematically inflicted on rural residents of Afghanistan by the U.S. Air Force. Terse, an incisive author and managing editor at Tom Dispatch, wrote this fall, "Over the last 20 years, the United States of America has conducted more than 93,300 airstrikes in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Pakistan, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen that killed between 22,679 and 48,308 civilians, according to figures recently released by AirWars, a UK-based airstrike monitoring group. The total number of civilians who have died from direct violence in America's wars since 9/11 tops out at 364,000 to 387,000, according to Brown University's Cost of War project. Actually, those deaths have been completely predictable results of U.S. government policies. And in fact, evidence of widespread civilian casualties emerged soon after the so-called War on Terror started 2 decades ago. Leaks with extensive documentation began to surface more than 10 years ago, thanks to stark revelations from courageous whistleblowers and the independent media outlet WikiLeaks. The retribution for their truth-telling has been fierce and unrelenting. WikiLeaks publisher Julian Assange is in a British prison facing imminent extradition to the United States, where the chances of a fair trial are essentially zero. Former U.S. Army intelligence analyst Chelsea Manning spent 7 years in a military prison. Former U.S. Air Force analyst Daniel Hale, who revealed the murderous effects of U.S. drone warfare, is currently serving a 45-month prison sentence. They had the clarity of mind and heart to share vital information with the public, disclosing not just mistakes, but patterns of war crimes committed by the United States of America. Such realities should be kept in mind when considering how the New York Times framed its blockbuster scoop last week, drawing on more than 1,300 confidential documents. Under the big headline, "Hidden Pentagon Records Reveal Patterns of Failure in Deadly Airstrikes," the Times assessed U.S. bombing in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan and reported that since 2014, the American air war has been plagued by deeply flawed intelligence, rushed and imprecise targeting, and the deaths of thousands of civilians, many of them children. What should not get lost in all bold-type words like failure, flawed intelligence, and imprecise targeting is that virtually none of it was unforeseeable. The killings have resulted from policies that gave very low priority to prevention of civilian death. The gist of those policies continues. And so does the funding that fuels the U.S. nonstop militarism, most recently in the $768 billion National Defense Authorization Act that spun through Congress this month and landed on President Biden's desk. Dollar figures are apt to look abstract on a screen, but they indicate the extent of the mania. Biden had only asked for $12 billion more than President Trump's last NDAA, but that wasn't enough for the bipartisan hawkery in the House and Senate, which provided a boost of $37 billion instead, actually factoring in other outlays for so-called defense. Annual U.S. military spending is in the vicinity of $1 trillion. Efforts at restraint have hit a wall. This fall, in a vote on a bill to cut 10% of Pentagon's budget, support came from only one-fifth of the House and not one Republican. In the opposite direction, House support for jacking up the military budget was overwhelming, with a vote of 363-70. And last week, when it was the Senate's turn to act on the measure, the vote was 88-11. Overall, military spending accounts for about half of the federal government's total discretionary spending, while programs for helping instead of killing are on the short rations for local, state, and national government agencies. It's a destructive trend of warped priorities that serves the long-term agendas of neoliberalism, aptly defined as policies that enhance the workings of free market capitalism and attempt to place limits on government spending, government regulation, and public ownership. While the two parties on Capitol Hill have major differences on domestic issues, relations are lethally placid beyond the water's edge. When NDAA cleared the Senate last week, the leaders of the Armed Services Committee were both quick to rejoice. I am pleased that the Senate has voted in an overwhelming bipartisan fashion to pass this year's defense bill, said the committee's chair, Senator Jack Reed, a Democrat from Rhode Island. The ranking Republican on the panel, Jim Inhofe from Oklahoma, chimed in. This bill sends a clear message to our allies that the United States remains a reliable, credible partner, and to our adversaries that the U.S. military is prepared and fully able to defend our interests around the world, unquote. The bill also sends a clear message to Pentagon contractors as they drool over a new meal in the ongoing feast of war profiteering. It's a long way from their glassed-in office suits to the places where the bombs fall.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
There is rising anger in West Africa region over continued French military presence. Now, recently, angry masses in Burkina Faso and Niger attempted to stop a French military convoy heading to Mali. Here is one of the protesters in Burkina Faso.
France has to leave, together with its weapons. That's it. That's what we want. We don't need a French army.
Hello and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Today, we are focusing on an upsurge of protests by West Africans who are demanding the complete withdrawal of French forces in the region. They say that despite the presence of these French troops, the region has seen increased attacks by Takfiri terrorists. Some people actually believe that French forces are supporting these terrorists in the region. Now, in the second part of our program, we shall talk about mixed-race women who are taken away from their Congolese mothers in infancy during colonial rule by Belgium. Now, these women have sued the Belgian state for committing a crime against humanity. So stay with us as our experts give us incisive analysis on these two issues.
West Africans reject French forces. Anger continues to boil over in the West Africa region over continued French military presence in its former colonies. Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger are former French colonies where the struggle against France's presence in the Sahel region of Africa has been most intense. Last November, there were protests against a French military convoy that was moving from the Ivory Coast to Gao in Mali, passing through Burkina Faso and Niger.
Now, the masses in this region have come out to protest against the presence of French troops in what is seen as new resistance against imperialist forces in the region. People protesting against French military forces in Burkina Faso are also suspicious about the cargo ferried by French military convoys.
What do they carry? What do they take with them every time that they leave for the Sahel? What we want today is that they are not going to pass. Even if we're going to spend 2 months here, we're set. We're not going to move. We don't want to negotiate. We're not asking for anything. What we're asking is just one thing. They can go home.
Well, now, for more on this, my colleague contacted Nefta Freeman, a coordinating committee member of the Black Alliance for Peace. Now, we first asked Mr. Freeman the reasons for renewed resistance against French neo-colonialism in the Sahel region of West Africa.
I think the reasons for the renewed resistance are that the people are, there's a number of reasons. One, the people are frustrated with neocolonialism, frustrated with the fact that neocolonialism prohibits them from having governments that are responsive to their basic needs, that their the resources in their country and that the markets and that their labor are being exploited ever since colonialism, just new forms of colonialism, for the interest of foreigners and the Western powers. There's also a sense and an understanding that French neocolonialism is on its last leg, just like neocolonialism in general is on its last leg. We can even see, I'm sure that our people in Africa and the Sahel and other places also see the destabilization of French colonialism in the Caribbean, in Martinique and Guadeloupe. And so these things inspire people. We've seen that in history where the weaknesses, certain weaknesses identified in colonialism give inspiration to others who are colonized under those same empires. So, and then even inside France itself.
While France has created media hype around the withdrawal of its forces in some parts of West Africa, it has actually expanded its main Sahel military base in the northern Mali city of Gao. The French army supply, which arrived in Africa in Ivory Coast last November, passed Burkina Faso and Niger before making it to the Gao military base. So what is the importance of this French military base in Gao?
Well, the French military base in Gao, Mali, was established first. I'm not sure, but the establishment was in the early 2000s, like 2011 or 13 or something, under the auspices of trying to fight terrorism. And so these are the same reason for U.S. military bases all over. France and the U.S. are serious about militarization of the continent of Africa. And this is the only thing that they have to maintain their dominance and hegemony on the continent of Africa, where they're seeing an increased Cold War with China, which China's methods of exerting their influence and finding and exercising their interests is through economic means. And actually a means that is helping build infrastructure. France and the U.S. don't have that same thing.
Now, masses protesting against the presence of French troops in West Africa are also suspicious that these foreign troops are secretly supplying weapons to Takfiri terrorist groups that threaten the region's security. Now, we asked Mr. Freeman to give us his take on reports by locals that French troops have been carrying weapons for Takfiri terrorist groups in the Sahel region of West Africa.
I think the local people in Burkina Faso and Niger have a very legitimate concern in terms of the presence of the suspicions around the convoy and the fact that it's not beneath these forces, France and even the U.S., to play both sides against the middle in order to justify or pursue their own interests, and the fact that terrorism has persisted. In spite of them saying that their presence is there to curtail terrorism. In fact, it's increased. A lot of studies have been done, and it makes sense that it would increase because of the anxiety people feel and the animosity people feel of having to experience the type of violence that they're experiencing, even at the hands of the Western powers that claim they're trying to fight terrorism.
The Sahel region is rich in mineral resources such as uranium, gold, and oil, and citizens in these countries believe France is supporting terrorists to justify its continued presence in the region with the specific objective of plundering these resources.
We also asked Mr. Freeman if the masses are justified in believing that French forces are in West Africa to continue looting the region's natural resources.
The people of those regions not only have legitimate concerns and their opinions are justified, they've actually even seen it. If we just look at the history of Mali, for example, a concrete example is that they started off at some point supporting the separatist movement, the Tuareg separatist movement, calling for independence in northern Mali. That was against the government in Mali. The National Movements for Liberation of Azawadi is what they supported. Then they turned around, because of the claims of, other Western powers professing that they're trying to fight terrorism, and they switched sides. And during that time, the French government is known to even support work with the corrupt governments in the interest of securing their interests around these very resources.
The anti-France sentiments in Burkina Faso have further been fueled by anger amid the trial of several people accused of assassinating the country's former president, Thomas Sankara.
The inquiry into Sankara's murder established that French agents were present in Burkina Faso the day after the assassination to destroy incriminating information on those involved. Sankara gained fame because of his popular anti-imperialist stances. Why do the people in Burkina Faso believe that Sankara was eliminated in a conspiracy backed by neo-colonial powers?
The history, is a very informative thing. And then when you talk about those countries that were under French colonialism, the people, especially this newer generation, it's widely known about Patrice Lumumba. It's widely known that imperialists were involved with the assassination of Patrice Lumumba. They actually orchestrated this. And that we also know that the stand that Thomas Sankara took, and particularly the United Nations, and talking about using the resources of the African continent for the African people, and that, just really calling out, so to speak, French imperialism and other imperialism on the continent of Africa, and then actually embarking on a path of a socialism and using the resources of Burkina Faso for the people and sort of democratic processes that you know, colonists don't stand for that. It interrupts their interest. And so, and they, we've seen throughout history where they will assassinate people, they will invade, they will do whatever to turn back, turn that back. So, it's a quite legitimate suspicion to have.
Malians have also taken to the streets of Bamako to demonstrate against the French military presence in Mali, calling for the total withdrawal of French troops from the country.
We are here for Mali. We are here to demonstrate our national sovereignty. Remind the whole world that sovereignty belongs to the people, and that those who have not understood this must get up to speed today, because the transition for us today is a result of decades of mismanagement, misgovernance of our country, and bad partnership.
These sporadic anti-France protests continue to rock various parts of West Africa. We asked Mr. Freeman if the mass demonstrations affect France's continued presence in the Sahel.
There's no way it can't affect it, but how will it affect it remains to be seen. Unfortunately, the reactionary nature of imperialism is to, they see their intent on continuing their dominance. And so the protests make them increase their repression. But at the same time, if as the protests become and the people become more organized and then sophisticated in their opposition, they could actually see some gains in pushing colonialism back and forcing other players on the international scene to call out and support their just struggle. So I think it will have impact.
Well, there you have it. Mr. Freeman says if protesters become more organized and sophisticated, then they can eventually compel French forces to exit the region. We now take a short break, and when we come back, we shall talk about the move by several women to take Belgium to court over some of the crimes it committed in the Congo during colonial rule. Stay with us.
Women sue Belgium over Congo war crimes.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Five mixed-race women born in Congo while under Belgian colonial rule have taken the former brutal colonial power to court. The women accused the Belgian state of crimes against humanity, insisting that they were taken away from their black mothers and separated from their African roots.
As expected, early December, these women lost the first round of their case in the Belgium court. They had hoped Belgium would recognize responsibility for the suffering of thousands of mixed-race children. Lawyers and relatives now say that they will appeal the Brussels court's ruling. The five women, all born between 1945 and 1950, filed their lawsuit last year amid growing demands that Belgium reassesses its colonial past. They still hope that the cases will be concluded during their lifetime.
Now, for more analysis on this subject, we contacted Julius Mbaluto, an African affairs analyst. Mr. Mbaluto first explains about the merits of the case brought up by these mixed-race women.
There's a lot of merit in this case. And why do I say so? Because they are right dealing with the issues. They have brought it to the fore. and they have support, of course, by United Nations, which is a good thing. I guess it was the pressure from United Nations in 2019 that made the Prime Minister of Belgium, Michael Charles, to apologize. And of course, we also saw the Catholic Church apologizing. So probably then we are talking about a reparation. We're talking about their compensation for the atrocities committed to them. And I do think the world will be behind them. I feel there's a lot of support on their case because, you know, we are talking about injustices. We are talking about killings of people. We are talking about discrimination of the highest level.
The women are demanding answers from the Belgian state on why they were snatched from their families and why they were made to suffer. They are asking for reparations for lives that were broken apart. These women, who are now grandmothers themselves, hope for the start of a new chapter and to resolve decades of trauma. One of the victims speaks here on their traumatic experience.
It's painful to reflect on. It was inhumane. I put myself back into the shoes of a tiny child who is searching for her mother. At two, you need your mother, her smell and her warmth, but there was none of that. There was just people around you you didn't recognize, didn't understand.
We asked Mr. Mbaluto about the emotional and psychological state of those who were kidnapped by Belgian colonial forces.
According to Belgian law, intermarriage between different races, especially blacks and also the whites in Democratic Republic of Congo, was illegal. And that being illegal, all children who were born out of mixed race, they were given names which were not nice names. When you call them Métis in French, or you call them mulatto, mulatto was the worst one because it was equating those children with animals. And therefore, you can imagine if someone comes to you today, they just say you are valued, you just equal like an animal. It's just not nice. And I can imagine when you, children don't forget stuff that easily, for them to go through that psychologically, it was a trauma. It was a trauma. And another thing is that the moment what we see happening, they were segregated, also separated from, you know, like the rest of the community.
Now, the women's lawyers said they were aged between 2 and 4 when they were taken away following orders by the Belgian colonial administration in collaboration with the local Catholic Church authorities. Mr. Mbaluto elaborates here on the role the Catholic Church played in the kidnappings of African mixed-race children from Congo during the colonial rule by Belgium.
The Catholic Church is not apologizing for nothing because it was partner to the colonial government. What used to happen was the system, government system that disallowed marriage between different races. Of course, for their own reason, they wanted to see not to be seen as equal with those whom they colonized, and therefore that narrative, the collusion between the colonial government of Belgium and Catholic Church, will see it that other children have been kidnapped. They will be kept within the Catholic Church, and it was actually the Catholic Church that facilitated their journey to Belgium. And also, those in there, they were kept, sent to orphanages through the Catholic Church as well.
The Belgian government issued what it called an apology for the role played by the colonial regime in taking thousands of young children away from their African mothers.
On behalf of the Belgian federal government, I apologize for the Métis of Belgian colonial origin and their families for the injustice and their suffering.
Is this so-called apology enough?
It's not enough. The sad news, or actually, even if, let's put it this way, even away from even the apology by the Catholic Church or even the Prime Minister, even if you give them money, even if it was millions, it can never be enough. See, it wouldn't bring back wonderful life experiences of living in a normal family, which was denied to these people. For children, it won't bring the joy of being a child and growing up seeing your parents from 4 years to 70. It won't bring back that. It won't bring back your position as a child and growing up in a neighborhood you are loved and you feel you are equal to your playmates. That it won't bring back all that.
This issue of kidnappings is just a tip of the iceberg because many other atrocities were committed during the Belgian colonial rule in Congo. From 1885 to 1908, King Leopold's brutal colonial rule saw nearly 10 million Congolese killed. Thousands had hands chopped off by his military because they had failed to deliver the harsh quotas of rubber that the colonialists demanded.
Now, is it about time to open the files of crime perpetrated by Belgium, especially regarding the genocide of millions of Congolese people? Here is Mr. Mbaluto's take.
When King Leopold ruled Congo from 1908, a lot of atrocities were committed. I think the estimation I've read in the past is close to 10 million people were killed. And you see, when you talk about the kidnappings of the children, it's just a drop in the ocean. You can begin to look into all these societies in the bigger picture of the crimes against humanity, the killings of millions of people, and also the way everyone else was treated. You know, our typical description of colonialism is pretty ruthless, unkind, brutal, unfair, unjust. There are many, I lack names to just keep on describing it. That's what it is, and it was brutal.
Well, Mr. Mbaluto there says no words are enough to describe the brutality meted out to Africans by colonial forces. Unfortunately, our time is up for today. But here at Africa Today, we shall continue highlighting the crimes committed by colonialists against the people of Africa. Well, that wraps it up for this week's edition of Africa Today. We hope you enjoyed the show. It will be great hearing from you, so send us your comments through our social media handle. Goodbye for now, and God bless you.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now, you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.